Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
What I'm picking up for you this first hour is what's referred to in this discussion as our American heritage, a Christian understanding of the Declaration of Independence and various other constitutional data in connection with the overall topic, Christian contributions to our American heritage. It struck me when we put the program together that you can't very well talk about Christian contributions to our American heritage unless you know something of what that American heritage is. And that's one of those general terms that you really can't take for granted, because our experience is that certain words like heritage and revival and freedom are just big generalities that everybody can say amen to and not really know much or define much about. But at the start of this, I just want to chat with you for a bit about our American heritage and what it is and what we understand by a Christian understanding of it. On my notes, I point out that when we say a Christian understanding, the word Christian there is used as a noun and not an adjective. It means the way I, as a Christian, understand these things. Now, that may be a little different than it reads in the data, see? If you just read the brochure may indicate that it's the way you, as Christians, should conceive of them. But that is not the thought or the intent in the background of my mind. In this case, when I say a Christian understanding of our American heritage and these things, what I'm really talking about is the way that I, as a Christian, see them and understand them. And since one of the great parts of that heritage is the right to be different and the right to express yourself differently, there may be others who would not use my same terminology or my same ideas. So nobody is bound to them, which is always good to know. But the concept of American heritage is not easily defined, because to one man it means one thing, and to one man it means another, and sometimes there's a great diversion of ideas. So I have tried to summarize it here with the general description in the very first note. That is the legacy of life that we ought to be allowed to live in these United States. And then in the third of these notes, I've tried to say it this way, that our heritage of citizens of this country is the concept of living in a state of voluntary subjection to laws, liberty under law, with the voluntary concessions of individuals in compact with one another for the betterment of the whole group. Oh, I hate to just bug you with a lot of big terms, and those are not very big terms, but the American heritage is the heritage of liberty under law, the voluntary conceding of certain individual rights and enactments in the pretended or real betterment of others. Now, I always say pretended or real because sometimes the voluntary sacrificing of individual rights, you can't really see always what the actual outcome of it may be. And you may get into a compact with people whose ideas are one thing and your ideas are something else. But that, in a nutshell, is what the American heritage is. Liberty under law, maximum freedom under a compacted situation in which individuals voluntarily set aside aspects of their personal privilege for the betterment of the total group. It's quite different than a dictatorship, where the heritage of a dictatorship is obedience to a single constituted authority. And it's quite different than a kingship, where the heritage of a kingship is the privilege of recognizing on earth potentates and powers of monarchical domain. It's quite different than the heritage of an anarchy. The heritage of an anarchy is everybody does his own thing, no matter who it infringes on or what it does. It is really the heritage of any bona fide republic. The right of people to exercise maximum freedom under agreeable laws, to which or for which they have sacrificed a certain amount of their personal privilege. That's the American heritage. Now, what we're interested in is Christian contributions to that, but this morning I'm working to try and define it, but that's the American heritage. Now, for 3 years over here in Hatfield, or 4 years, I've had a garden on the property that's owned by Bible Evangelism Incorporated. Just up the road here a ways. Right now it looks like the kingdom of the weeds, but it's just up the road, and I garden it. They're good enough to let me have a plot. 3 years ago, George Clark, the registrar, and I here pioneered it by opening a small section. He gardened half and I gardened half. It was tough work, but we won't go into the details. Last year, Michael Aramick, one of our students, also opened up a section. So we divided the plot three ways. Clark, Taylor, and Aramick, say. Now, in that compact, I agreed not to garden on Clark's ground and not to garden on Aramick's ground. Now, actually, I was the outsider. I had no legitimate claim other than the fact that they're good to be here, and I am good to them, but I had no legitimate claim otherwise to be there. So, but you see, there's a kind of a compact, voluntary, they agreed to set aside a certain amount of their rights as possessors of the land that we might work together at farm. That's part of the American heritage. Now, 3 years ago, I discovered that Mr. Aramick was not using his. In the middle of July, two-thirds of it was still grown up in weeds. Consequently, I just moved my line about 3 feet. Then I moved it 3 more feet. Then I moved it 3 more feet. Then I moved it 3 more feet. He came out one day, and I said, if you want his ground, I said, you can have what I planted and the stuff that grows on. Well, in a sense, see, I was infringing on his land. And he could have looked up and said, well, I'll take those beans for myself. Wouldn't have done him much good if it had an early frost that year and they were all killed. But in a sense, he could have looked and said, I'll take those beans for myself. But in the nature of the American heritage, he could have done it. Just technically, see, in the nature of possession and right. But in the nature of heritage, there is a volunteering surrendering. And one part of that is often the volunteering surrendering of something which you don't use, as with all of the land acts, for the benefit of those who do use. Now, I don't want to kill you on this, because we always hate to have a lot of people leave after the first hour and never come back. But the American heritage is that right of liberty under law, whereby people live in a compacted agreement by conceding certain things that might be part of their individual rights, but for the betterment of the whole, they set them aside. That's why the Declaration of Independence says the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness is a totally different thing than the actual possession of happiness. Of course, we know spiritually that happiness is not gained by pursuit and by things and by a lot of other stuff too. But that, in a nutshell, is the American heritage. Now, I briefly note some of the things that are contributed to that. Briefly. The early colonials of this country, like many of us today, I suppose, yet, but the early colonials were rugged individualists. The people who came to Jamestown did not come looking for religious freedom. The people who came to Jamestown came as part of a merchandising empire to help make some men who were already rich somewhat richer. The people who came to Jamestown hoped for a better life for themselves, and we trust by God's grace that many of them found it. But they came to Jamestown in the profound expectation of a merchandising empire which took a long, long time to get off the ground. And consequently, the whole economy of Virginia, if you're a Virginian, my apologies, but the whole economy of Virginia floundered for years because it became increasingly necessary for the Virginia proprietors to recruit men from England in strange ways to get them here, especially after 2 or 3 massacres that rubbed out a few. But in a nutshell, that was the thrust. Now, those men who came to New England came looking for religious freedom for themselves. They didn't come looking for it for anybody else. I love the Puritans and the Pilgrims, and I even love the Anglicans in Virginia. I like them all for their rugged determination. But none of them came for religious freedom for anybody but themselves. And so if your name was Roger Williams, and you had strange ideas around Boston, he had a lot of strange ideas, incidentally. Before the Baptist brethren jump up and down in delight over Roger Williams, they should read his Total Theology a couple of times. But anyhow, that's neither here nor there. If your name was Roger Williams and you were at Plymouth Bay, it was bad news. Or if your name was Thomas Hooker, it was bad news. If your name was Miles Standish, it was all right as long as you weren't proposing to women or having somebody else do it for you. You could survive on a lot of things like that. Now, I don't criticize them, but I just point out that that's how it was. There was no real freedom of religion in New England, nor was there much freedom of anything else. When those simple peasants wanted to dance the Maypole dance, and Governor Bradford wrote and sent them back, it's really quite an astonishing thing. Now, I by no means am a libertarian. I'm merely pointing out that in the early colonial concept, there was very little idea of liberty under law. They were still carrying with them the English constitutional idea. They were still carrying with them very emphatically the heritage of obedience to a constituted inherited king. That situation was not true in Pennsylvania. That's not true in Pennsylvania, and also not true in parts of New Jersey. Pennsylvania, of course, came into the colonial situation through the agency of William Penn, a Quaker. Penn was an interesting fellow. And the result was that Pennsylvania and northern New Jersey were soon saturated by Quakers and Anabaptists and all kinds of other people. And years later, many of the Anabaptists, whom today we would call Mennonites, flocked in. There were two massive migrations to this part of the world. About 1740, 1750, a massive Mennonite migration into this part of Pennsylvania, followed in the 1860s by another massive migration of Anabaptist peoples from central and other parts of Europe. So the concept in the central colonies of Pennsylvania, and to a certain extent part of New Jersey, likewise Delaware, the concept that existed in those colonies was a concept of community much closer to the American heritage than either New England or Virginia. Maryland had a very unhappy history. Lord Calvert founded it for the Catholics, largely, so that they could have a refuge in this country. But within 50 years of Calvert's founding, the Protestants had got a hand of it and made it illegal for Catholics to live there. It went through a very strange kind of situation. And while Oglethorpe was building Georgia for a penal colony, it soon became in itself not liberty under law, but liberty under the king. And that sea is different than the American heritage as I defined it somewhat earlier. The American heritage is the concept of liberty under law, whereby individuals are compacted together in a state where they voluntarily surrender some of their, say, rights, if you will, they might otherwise exercise for the betterment of the whole. However, the early colonials, and the later colonials too, the early colonials did contribute a lot to American heritage. They contributed a great deal of what we call rugged individualism and the concept of the willingness or the right to do what you think God wants you to do. Now, in the 18th century, a lot of deists came to this country. You know, at the time of the Revolution, it's estimated that less than 6% of the population belonged to any professed church. Belonged. Of course, in New England, they kind of all belonged in that the towns couldn't be very good to belong. But we mean in a sense of affiliation. Estimated by Gausted in his History of Religious History of American Peoples that less than 6% of the Revolution belonged to any kind of a church. Most of us have realized for years that belonging to a church and being Christian are oftentimes two different things. During the 18th century, the 1700s, a great stream of persons, especially from England, who couldn't take the religious establishment in England stream in this country, many of them were deists, some were agnostics, but they were all deists and agnostics of what we call a more peaceable sort. They still had some kind of respect for the deity, wherever he was, or whatever he was happening to be doing. Thomas Jefferson is grade A example one of that particular group, and Franklin is not far behind him. They are examples of men who still had a powerful respect for deity, but did not really know the God of the Bible. But they weren't like these modern blasphemers who run up and down the street denouncing anything supernatural or above them that they can't understand. There's quite a difference in climate. These men contributed in the background of America a concept of investigative studies and sciences. And when you put them all together, I note that the American heritage from the colonial period, and that the American heritage draws three big things out of the colonial period. First is the willingness to dare to act in accord with what understands to be the will of God. That eventually would lead men to lay apart parts of their freedom because they believed that the will of God was for this compacted society. And the second thing I mention is to be responsible for formative acts. Formative acts mean decrees and statements, like the Declaration of Independence, to put your name on something that means something, that are calculated to meet the immediate situation. So that Jefferson says, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for these things to transpire, rather than being in bondage to something that is oppressive and tyrannical and despotic, we will declare ourselves. And this, he says, is what men ought to do. Now that is still, see, building towards the American heritage. The American heritage, in its best expression, comes with the Revolution and with the Constitution and not before it. But as I said at the start of this hour, I'm giving you my concepts, huh? Is a good word in my vocabulary, but my concepts. The heritage as we know it existed very little before the Revolution. If you were a Baptist in Virginia or a Presbyterian, you would wind up in jail if you preached anywhere but in your own meeting house. Sam Davies, the Presbyterian evangelist, was in hot water all the time on the Virginia frontier in the 1730s, 1740s, 1750s, up to the French and Indian War. And he was in hot water all the time. I guess we shouldn't speak of a Presbyterian being in hot water, but you can take it in the right sense and understand what I mean. He was in hot water all the time, in prison, under harassment, under orders not to preach, because there was an established church in Virginia, and it wasn't the Presbyterian church. Actually, the American Heritage, see, as we know a liberty under law, the revolution kind of drew together all trends of individualism and force before it and mushroomed in the idea that peoples could be compacted together voluntarily, giving up some parts of their individual rights. Now, there were some precedents for that in the early days. Among their own group, the Mayflower Compact, for example, the Massachusetts Constitutions, all of those things in their own group represented something of the same thing. But I mentioned chiefly these three things. I didn't mention the third one, I think, but I better mention it. That out of these formative things came this concept of the ultimate worth of man. Deists and Christians alike thought that man was worth something and worth more than just shooting. Now, that actually brings me to the American Heritage thing, which I've defined about six times and repeated until after a while I get confused and contradict myself and wind up saying hail to the Queen or something. But see, the Heritage thing is big with me. The American Heritage thing is not just the right to jump up on the soapbox and scream that the governor is bad or something like that. It is the concept of liberty under law. Laws made by the voluntary compacting of individuals who are willing to give up some aspects of what might personally be their rights. When I was a kid, the biggest boys always won the fights. Not always. Sometimes little boys won, but I was never one of the little boys that won. I was one of the little boys that usually lost. And consequently, you ganged yourself around the biggest kids. I didn't live in the city, I lived in the country. It doesn't make any difference. If there's going to be a confrontation, you group yourself. I followed a fellow named Norman Thomas, no relation to socialists. Norman Thomas was 16 and in the fourth grade. The leader of the rival group, there were only four grades in one room, so he knew them all well. Norman had been there for 6 years. The leader of the rival group was named Sylvan Schmidtkin. He was also 16 and in the fourth grade. They're probably both rich today. Everybody went to grade school with a dropout, either has a big business or is rich today. So they're probably both rich today. Well, they were men of just about equal strength. They never fought. They never fought. They agreed not to fight each other. I don't mean they sat down with pen and ink. But why wear yourself out when your peasants could do the dirty? They were not sure that either one, they never fought. Each one sacrificed a bit of his aggressiveness towards the other in order that they could have peace between themselves. The little boy should have been so smart. That's the American Heritage, liberty under law. Not just freedom, that's what we hear so much of, freedom, but in the American Heritage, freedom is sacrificed by individuals in a voluntary compact for the betterment of the whole. Now, if you've been a political science major in high school or college or graduate school or someplace, you may think that I'm totally ignorant of that fact. It's one of the big things in constitutional history. And that's why the preamble of the Constitution starts with those interesting words, we the people of the United States, in order to form, etc., 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 and so forth. Now, when we come to the American Heritage itself, from the spiritual side of the ledger, I wanted to mention about three things real quick like. The founders of the nation, deists, agnostics, and Christians, were still, as I mentioned a few moments ago, by and large, conscious and respectful of deity. The Jefferson Bible would astound you. See, today a lot of my theological friends, they worry about the Living Bible and they worry about their own translations, but the Jefferson Bible, in which practically everything is cut out except a few platitudes, his own edition, would astound you. He's fond to say, but he was still enormously respectful of deity. Can you see it? That doesn't save a man. If you'll forgive me for sounding like an evangelist, that doesn't save a man, but that greatly conditions his attitudes in life. For the man who is respectful of deity, 9 times out of 10, is respectful of the things that deity has made, like you. 9 times out of 10. Now, he did not see everything with great perspective, I suppose, but the concepts of the founders of the nation, there were some really godly men among them. I have 2 or 3 books down in the bookstore on sale that enumerate a few. There were some really godly men among them. But by and large, there was a tone of a total group who thought in terms of the benevolent deity, and they hoped that he would smile on them. And some men prayed to him fervently, and others said nice things about him. Of course, we know that if a man does not know Christ, he does not, we understand that theologically, I hope. There's only one way of salvation through the Lord Jesus, no matter what one says about God, however nice it is. But an attitude of respect towards the deity is a vast improvement over Hitler or somebody like that, and over tyrants in general. So when we come down to the American heritage, the spiritual side of the ledger, what you really find out is that in the early days of the colonies, freedom under law was always limited to just me and my friends. We could have our game in our colony, and with the exception of Pennsylvania and parts of New Jersey, you could not play on our field. Period. But as the mutual hostility towards England grew, so a recognition of comradeship of theological beliefs grew. And after the war, you quickly discovered that with the single exception of the Anglican Church, the major religious bodies are loud for tolerance. Now, it took a while to get it in New England because there were political overtones too. But in Virginia, under the leadership of Jefferson to a certain extent, and Lee, Jefferson and Lee, with the strong backing of Baptists and Presbyterians united for a change, under that strong backing, Virginia was the first state to declare that there would be no established religion. Now, of course, ironically, it was the one that had the strongest established religion in the 18th century. In the 17th century, it may have been a little different. New England might have been stronger. But Virginia became the leader in that thing under the impetus of Christian groups who previously could hardly tolerate each other. I don't want to kill the whole hour on this, but see, don't say that your group never persecuted anybody unless it's never had a chance. I just finished reading a book on Anabaptist history a few days ago, Estep's book. Estep talks, and I'd like to think that I love all these guys, but Estep talks at great length how he never persecuted anybody, but he never in the whole book mentions the Munster Theocracy, which was the one time that a nation was headed by Anabaptist leaders. Never mentions it once. Well, no ill will to him. I mean, it's just the way it goes in life. When I write books that would protect my people, I don't mention what they've done wrong either. I'm part of a persecuted group. We've really been persecuted. With my theological but you see, if you were a Baptist and lived in Scotland, it was bad news. They could hardly tolerate you. And if you were a Presbyterian in England before the days of Cromwell, and then just after the days of Cromwell, it was likewise trouble. Now, the concept to live in a community of others and have a difference of opinion just was hardly known at all. But with the coming of the Revolution, the religious bodies in America, I'm speaking now of honest religious bodies, saw the need of a willingness not just to tolerate, but to live acceptably one with another. Before the Revolution, there was not a church in the country that would give you a communion if you were not a member of it. Now, of course, the Quakers didn't give anybody communion. They didn't celebrate it. And I couldn't say, see, I'm not smart enough to say, no, there was not one anywhere. But the general rule was that they would not. But shortly after the Revolution, by 1800, the idea of closed communion had been limited almost totally to the hierarchical churches. Almost totally. There are exceptions yet today because people don't change in one mass. And I can't tarry there longer. That's part of the spiritual heritage. The churches realizing that they would have to live in acceptance of one another for the common welfare. Because if they didn't, then you'd have the Galatian situation that they would bite and devour one another and they would soon all be consumed. If the Lutherans and Calvinists and Zwinglians had known that in Germany in the days of the Reformation, all of Europe would have gone to the Reformation. No question about it at all. But so much of their time was spent in intolerance of each other that the enemies really lapped them up like mad from time to time. Now, I can't tarry there. I want to push ahead and mention another aspect with regard to the political side of the ledger. On the back two pages of these notes, I have reprinted with my own fumbling style the Declaration of Independence. How many have read it in detail? How many have really read the Declaration? Good. That's good. That's not an altar call, so we don't report those hands. So I'm just wondering how many have really done it. You'll discover that there are hundreds of Americans who've never had it. You'll discover that there are a few that have. For everyone who's read the Declaration of Independence, it'll take 20 who've read the Declaration to find somebody who's read the Constitution. We will not ask that question. But generally speaking, it really isn't done. I've carried for years copies of booklets on the Constitution. I'm not a great authority on it, but I like to read it. Of course, this particular copy I have up here is annotated. Sometimes his notes are not all about it. Better to read the straight text from the commentary sometimes. Declaration of Independence is pretty striking stuff, but the first thing you realize is that it's hardly written on a spiritual basis. Don't feel badly about that. Jefferson penned it himself, but there are a number of respectful statements of deity. This is July the 8th, that Lee brought the resolution. They've been having an all the Philadelphia radio programs. July the 8th, Lee brought the resolution to Congress that the Declaration should be drafted. A committee of five men with Jefferson head was appointed to it. Jefferson thought himself that Lee, Richard Henry Lee, ought to do the writing himself, but Lee was not that good a penman. He wrote with the Palmer method or something like that. And so the job eventually went to Jefferson, who apparently composed a good deal. It is hardly a spiritual document, but every time that deity is touched on, it's done so respectfully. So he says the concept is the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them. Nature's God. That can be interpreted in several different ways, but that's typical of the expression. But I've reproduced the whole Declaration of Independence just for one particular line to show you the political point of view. But from a spiritual point of view, it's hardly an exegetical document. But from a political point of view, the Declaration of Independence is not being written by men who are leaving the crown. It's written by men who, in their minds, have already left the crown. Never once do they refer to the king as our king. He is always the impersonal George. He is always their king. And when you come over to the third paragraph on the second page, he has excited domestic insurrections among us. Among us. See, not among his people, but among us. And in paragraph 7, he's constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on high seas, to bear arms against their country. The Declaration of Independence is not written by men who think of themselves as Englishmen leaving the crown. It's written by Americans who think of themselves as not being part of the crown. You can see that rather quickly, I think. Now, the long list of abuses of George III, if he were really guilty of all those things, in the degree to which the Declaration portrays him, lightning should have hit him on the spot several times. He was guilty of plenty, but maybe more oversight. First, if I were living then, it might feel totally different. But down here in New Jersey, Mr. Mackey, formerly a pastor in New Jersey, will know my friend Mr. Howe. Remember Mr. Howe? The Howe family in New Jersey has had their property longer than everybody else in New Jersey except one family. They've had title deeds for property since like 1680. That's a long time ago. And they lived on the same ground. And I won't go into that any further, but during the early days of the Revolution, in 1777, British gunboats steamed up the Delaware in the evening, or towards dusk. Saw a light where the Howells had them. Their Howells house is within 42 stones throw of the Delaware River. And so the British fired a cannonball over that way just to see what was up. And not an exploding thing, just a big lumbering thing, which came through the kitchen area in the back of the house, went through the roof, went through the floor, and is in a museum today, see. It went through the floor, and they still got a patch in the roof, which may be the original patch, but anyhow, it's through the floor. And then when nobody fired back, they concluded that it wasn't a bunch of enemies, so they landed on the shore, found 4 or 5 cows in the field, and the British sailors had a barbecue of one of Mr. Howell's great-great-great-grandfather's cows. The next morning, James Howell, 5 generations ago, walked out, saw that they barbecued his cow, got into a skiff and rowed over to the British warboat and yelled for the commandment. And the commandment dropped a line to him, and he got up and he handed the commandment a bill for a hole in his house and the stealing of his cow. After all, he said, I'm an Englishman. He said, you put a hole in my house and you've stolen my cow. And he handed him a bill for the hole in the house and stealing the cow, and the commander of the English ship paid him. I don't know. Paid him. Well, he could have thrown him in the river. But see, when the Declaration says he has ravished our coast and many, many other things, you realize that there you get the irony. I'm not unhappy with it, but there you get the irony of people who make the strongest. Well, they did blockade the Port of Boston. They did blockade Virginia. They did a lot of strong, mighty things. No argument about it. But the Declaration is written politically to bring people to a point where they are ready, as he says in the earlier part of it, where they are ready to form a new government. Prudence will dictate that government long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. And he goes ahead and discusses the patient's nation, the patient's suffering that they've gone through, and how the necessity of the new government is laid upon them. So whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it's the right of the people to alter, abolish it, or to institute new government laying its foundation, etc. That's at the start of paragraph 3. So actually what the Declaration of Independence is doing is bringing a band of people to the point where, feeling common concern, they are willing to set apart bits of private right for the betterment of the whole. Now, our American heritage is just that. It is liberty under law. Liberty under law. The voluntary compactment of individuals for the betterment of the group, in which individuals willingly give up portions of what otherwise might be part of their right. The question we often run into is, what if I resent this part of my right that my grandfather gave up? What do I do now? We are still under the compact of laws where there's constant revision, for better or for worse. Nothing in the whole governmental system was seen as fixed and static and eternal. Scripture alone is that. Consequently, there's a constant revision, and some rights are retaken, and some are voluntarily set apart. I can't say more about the Declaration of Independence, I don't think. I can't say much more either about the Constitution and its preamble, which is one of the most fascinating of all documents. Just a little preamble for the purposes of the whole thing. But my conclusion is just this, that our American heritage is liberty under law, is compacted in common interest with equal participation of all who have not in some way forfeited that right. Now, what I mean by that is that if you shoot a man on the street, then you have forfeited your right to sit down and talk about the social laws and how to live with each other. If you strangle the professor by his microphone, you have forfeited a certain right to discuss how to deal with problems in class. That's what it boils down to. And consequently, our American heritage is those things. In this way, it's the right to persist in seeking to form more complete aspects of government. So I note these things in the American heritage. The fiat, we are free to propagate whatever your view happens to be, but not to exterminate. If your view is to kill everybody, then you are not free to propagate it. We have already surrendered that freedom under the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. We've surrendered the freedom to destroy it all next to you. We've surrendered that in order that together we might be able to live peaceably. The freedom to propagate, not to exterminate. When the Jehovah's Witnesses folks used to come around selling a literature door to door and playing the phonograph records, I used to have theological friends who wished the law was outlawed. But you see, we cannot do that. Now, we can make it so that people can't camp on your doorstep for hours, I suppose, but we cannot do that, for under the American heritage, we have the right to propagate but not to exterminate. And that means you have to be willing to put up with the seeds, the things that you disapprove of or disagree with, if the common welfare is to be promoted. Now, if a particular group argues against the Constitution and argues for a violent overthrow of the government, then they are outside the compact of laws. That's quite another matter. They are free to propagate, not to exterminate, free to grow, but not to destroy alternate growth. You are free to build as big a church as the Lord will let you build. But the day that you go out and burn down the one down the street from you, then you have forfeited the American heritage. You are free to grow, but not to curb growth. Likewise, to express but not to thwart. I have published a little newspaper here. You will not see it because it's only a thing of dignity for the men during the seminary year. People see it are a little shocked at the things we do. I'm free to express, but I'm not free to hire a goon squad to keep others from expressing to me. And even in my freedom to express, if my expression thwarts somebody's aims, then I have lost the American heritage concept also. Free to criticize, but not to annihilate. Free to speak, and not to silence spokesmen. Now, in terms of the Declaration of Independence, it boils down to this, that we are not only free to do those things, we are responsible to do those things. Jefferson says in the Declaration, he says, we cannot do otherwise. We must make our voice heard. So that freedom, the right to live in a compact, liberty under law, is a thing which cannot lie dormant. It must be expressed, or it will kill itself. Though we don't really fear alternative views if we are expressing our own. And we don't really fear alternative opinions if we are expressing our own. And if the alternative opinions become the dominant ones, if we have permitted forwards become the dominant ones, then we are merely allowing history to run its course. And it is proven already that no civilization is eternal, only spiritual things like that. Now, what I've been trying to discuss this morning, it's been a kind of a curious lecture, I think, but what I've been trying to discuss this morning is simply the concept of what is our American heritage. If we're going to talk about Christian contributions to it, our American heritage is not just the right to worship where you believe. It's not just the right to speak or say or gather on Sunday. Our American heritage is the right to have liberty under law, to live in a compacted relationship with others in which the voluntary concessions of yourself are made for the benefit and the betterment of all. That's what the heritage is. And in terms of historical development, it is just about the only country in the world where that kind of heritage is known. They've come to know more of it in other parts of the world through many different ways. But here, it is kind of an inherent growth. It's kind of a plant, a cultivated thing. I have to stop there.
You know, when I was a boy going to school, I never heard that the Revolutionary forces lost any battles at all. Everybody goes to their own school, I suppose. I went to a little one in western Pennsylvania. I don't know if it was more or less patriotic. It's one of those things you can't tell about. But I went there just the same, and for the first 6 years of my life, school life, after some bitter experiences living in the city with my grandparents and flunking kindergarten, I was out in the country where I went to a school that didn't have eight rooms, didn't have eight classes in one room, but did have four classes in one room. We had a two-room school. And when I got to sixth grade, they enlarged it, and we had a four-room school. And then my parents moved to another farm, and I went to a big school that had a room for every class. So I enjoyed all those educational luxuries. But I never heard that the Revolutionary forces lost a single battle. In high school, I discovered that there had been a couple discouraging moments, and in college, I had a great debunker of American history who even made Yorktown sound like a defeat, and Cornwallis just quit too soon. I survived him by the skin of my teeth, so to speak. When we moved to Hatboro several years ago, I'm not really an historian, see, or a great student of it, but I enjoy history. When we moved to Hatboro several years ago, the greatest shock of my life as a historian occurred when I discovered that the Yankees, who were watching over the Crooked Billet, a notable place of retirement in Hatboro and other places, had a big party one night and slept in the next morning. While they were sleeping in, they were surprised by the Redcoats, who had had a disciplined night's sleep with no beverages to embellish their day. They caught our forefathers in bed with their breath still not able to pass an analyzer test. And they were soundly defeated. It was a small battle, the Battle of the Crooked Billet. And it's been recorded the people who slept there knew why the billet was called crooked. But a small battle, but just one of those interesting things. It aroused my curiosity in a lot of aspects of history that I haven't really had time to research fully. There are a lot of ironies. And so the thing that I laid out for this theological institute was what I've referred to in my paper as strange bedfellows, meaning the way whereby men of very diverse theological and social views were bound together in the revolution, or whatever you want to call it, as far as our history and heritage was concerned. Strange bedfellows, the way great and godly men could sit down and write up a document side by side with some character who wasn't sure there was a God and wasn't even sure where he was, if he was, or when he was. A strange kind of a circumstance. And it's part of that great panorama that makes American history not unique, maybe, but makes it interesting. We are close to it. See, if you go to England and tell them you're celebrating, I haven't been to England for a while, but I have been there once or twice in years past. And if you go to England and tell somebody you're celebrating something that's 200 years old, they hardly even yawn. 200 years in England is nothing. Some families have lived on the same property for almost 1,000 years. They're not at all impressed by American history. At least they weren't in my limited context. See, when somebody said, what was the button I wore? It was for the sesquicentennial celebration of the town near where our farm was. Well, it says 150 years. He said, in England, he said, we don't begin to count anniversaries till they've gone twice that long. Well, be that as it may, because of the nature, we are much closer to our foundation than you would be if you lived in England or in Saxony. I'm not sure about Italy, or any of the other countries of the Western world, the European world. It's all happened within your lifetime. Well, not actually, see, but within your great-great-grandfather's lifetime, the whole historic element has developed. And around this part of the country, you'll find many people whose fathers you know, I mean by that their forebears lived on the same land where they now live. And as I mentioned the other day, my friend in South Jersey, they have held the property since 1680 in their family name. He said to me with a mark of triumph, he said, "We've lived here longer on this land and held title to it than any other family in New Jersey except one." And he said, "I want to tell you," he said, "he's a sick old man with no children." Whereas the man who was telling me was still full of life and has four rugged sons anxious to maintain his estate. He said, "It's just a matter of time until the Howell property is the oldest one in New Jersey held by the same family." Well, see, it's all within the environs of recent history. It doesn't seem that way to me. I was born in 26 or 27 or sometime like that there. We don't worry too much about the years. And so 200 years ago seems like a long time to me, but not really when you scope the whole thing together. Not really. When you walk out in the street and meet somebody whose great-grandfather knew Washington personally. I mean, he's an old man today, and his great-grandfather would be a lot older. Well, you know, there's a closeness of history. And so I have looked over the American history scene and looked back at this revolutionary thing and thought of what I've referred to here in this institute as strange bedfellows. The way in which men were bound together who were very diverse in every other sort of way. The difference between John Witherspoon, of whom I will say more in a minute, a fine godly preacher, and Thomas Jefferson, a gentleman but an absolute deist, the difference in them socially, politically, and religiously was almost total. And yet, hand in hand, they worked with the Continental Congress. Witherspoon is the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. But hand in hand, they worked for what they call common cause. That's what I refer to as strange bedfellows. Now, I'm not interested in it only as an historic illustration. I'm interested in it for what little ideas may be gleaned out of it to help us in present crisis and present challenge. Let me note for you, I don't have anything printed this afternoon. I almost always do, but this has been a bad week in the printing department for reasons we'll not get into at this time. But let me note for you initially four background notes, four basic ideas behind, or before rather, I don't mean as causes, but before the revolutionary epoch. Let me note for you four background notes as basic ideas behind the revolutionary epoch, just as background material, four basic ideas. One of them was what I just referred to. Here I'm going to pronounce a word which always makes a lot of people cringe, but I have always said heterogeneous. And some of my colleagues say heterogeneous, see, and you just spell it out for yourself. Now, let's use the word diverse. The diversity of the settled areas in the New World. The diversity of the settled areas in the New World. What I mean by that is that America was settled very much by nationality groups. Now, the bulk of them were English-speaking, but that did not make them one people. There's as much difference in the days of King George III between a Scotsman and a Welshman and an Englishman as there would be between them today or at any given time in history. So to this country came ethnic groups, and they settled in their own cell structures. There's very little exception to that. Pre-revolution, very little exception to that. There was practically nobody in New England. Practically nobody but Englishmen. Dissenters largely from the Commonwealth of Great Britain, from England proper. Practically nobody but them. There was practically nobody in what we would call New York. Well, New York had three groups territorially divided. The lower group became English in time. The middle group was Dutch. The upper group were rather Germanish. The Dutch group went as far as Albany. There was a German settlement beyond that. And when I say practically nobody, I don't mean one man. I mean a mass group of people. The Scots came in great numbers, largely to North Carolina, South Carolina, parts of Pennsylvania, parts of New Jersey. The Irish went pretty much where the Scots went, but largely stayed in their own enclaves. People from the Low Countries and Switzerland flocked very much to the central colonies, to Pennsylvania in particular. But a certain segment of them also went to North Carolina. That is largely why your Moravian church in this country divides its strength between North Carolina and Pennsylvania. They're not Low Countryers, but they were accompanied by some. But they came to this country and set up essentially the same kind of culture that they knew back in the old world. Can't elaborate on that, I don't think, but they did that. So that they actually were an extension of themselves in the old world. And yet somehow in this country, they gained an affinity for each other that they never had in the old world. And that was because they needed each other. Now, I don't like to be too philosophically oriented on that, but the Scots lived in Scotland and never needed the Irish. In fact, hated them a good bit of the time. Of course, Northern Ireland was settled by Scots. If you're of Irish extraction, the Orangemen were almost all Scots in background. Now, some of them argue that Scotland was settled by Northern Irishmen. It's one of those things you can argue about for a while. But they never really needed the other party back in that country. But in this land, they suddenly did. They were a long way from home, trying to maintain the same type of community, and trapped by the ocean on one side and the mountains and the forests on the other. Suddenly, any other human being looked good to them. So that diversified population in this country became one of those basic background notes before the war. The truth of the matter is that before long, you may have seen at Valley Forge that Washington had to go out and settle a fight between the Irish and the German soldiers on at least one occasion, but shortly before the war, see, in this country, Englishmen who lived in New York felt closer to the Dutch who lived at Albany than they did to the English who lived in England. Much closer. That's a big background factor. The second one is the simple expanse of the country. The simple expanse of the country. This is a giant land compared to European countries, with a single exception of Russia. It is a giant land. Now, if you live in Brazil, that's another continent, see, it's different. But if you live in Brazil or China or Canada or Russia, then there's nothing, or China, there's nothing remarkable about the size of this country. But if you live almost any place else, there is. Australia, too, is pretty big. If you live in the Netherlands, this is a monstrous country. I remember going to a train station in the Netherlands and asking, I wanted to go and see where Cornelius Vormerdam's place, or not Vormerdam, what's his name? Cornelius Vanderbregen's place was. Thought I'd like to go and see it. Asked the fellow about going there, told him I wanted to go, and he looked at me with amazement. He said, why, he said, that's complete, his English was about like my Dutch. He said, that's clear across the country, he said, too far, too far. And I took his word for it, but I discovered the next day that clear across the country was 48 miles. See, I've driven further than that to get a hamburger or a pizza. So the sheer expanse of this country gave the colonists a feeling of independence. Now check me on that. They felt a proximity one for another, like in the film last night, the Virginians and the Bostonians. They felt a proximity one for another, but the nature of the country gave them what I call the big man complex as far as England was concerned. They were in a land obviously bigger and richer than the place they had come from. They were all like Texans. You know, everything is bigger here. The streets have more bumps here. They were all with that kind of an image. And it was really not like in England. You can go back and see how Samuel Johnson and these boys felt about the travelers who came back with their... Of course, England was much more civilized in many ways. But here was a land much bigger, much richer, and the colonists, a lot of them, became big braggarts. The third factor in background was their common experience, forgive me, it's a little melodramatic, but the common experience of crossing that ocean. A giant step. If you want to get a sensation of it, you get yourself a little sunfish sailboat and sail across Lake Superior. Now, I have not done that. I went with a fellow across Lake Erie and died three times across and back to get the feeling of that. That's a little lake, but there was a point where I could see no land, had no reason to think he had any idea that he knew where he was headed at all. And when I said to him, you know where you're going, he said, it's not that big a lake. Keep going sooner or later. Well, they had the common experience of crossing the ocean, not a light thing. Of course, the ocean crossings had begun with Columbus, with three of his ships. We always say that he really left with four, but that one fell off the edge. They never haven't found it yet. But the ocean crossing business began with Columbus. We're amazed that a man like George Whitefield, the evangelist, who traveled across the ocean seven times, in 14 trips, seven round trips across the ocean by boat, we're amazed at a fellow like that. Franklin did it a few times, too, but it was an experience of weeks, see. They had that common experience of leaving everything, getting on a dinky ship, and sailing across the ocean. If any of you were here the other night to see the film In God We Trust, they went up to the Mystic Seaport and looked at the whaling boat. A fellow took me to Mystic a couple of years ago, and we stood on the whaling boat, and I was amazed at how small it is. I don't know what the size is, 135 feet or something, but it is a small boat. I've seen bigger yachts on the Delaware. And the idea, see, of going bag and baggage, that is a common experience. And then lastly, in this background notes, these people who were together with that common experience, doesn't make any difference when they came, whether it was 1607 or 1750, the experience had hardly changed a lick. The improvement in sailing vessels between 1600 and 1800 was almost nil. The clipper ships marked a big improvement, but it was almost nil otherwise. So whether they had come earlier or later, the experience was very similar. Now, the sailing time from England to America was almost identical from 1600 until the days of Matthew Maury, when in 1848 he prescribed trade wind routes to follow to get across faster. He cut the time by 21 days, I think. But up, that's another story, too. The last thing that I wanted to mention as background material was this concept of varied philosophies. And not something they held in common. But each group kind of looked at itself, as I said a few moments ago, as an extension of the mother culture, kind of looked at itself as an extension of the mother culture with its own interests. By and large, the Germans were not interested in becoming like English, and the English were not interested in becoming like Germans. But as I said earlier, they felt a common need for each other. And after a while, the three points that I previously mentioned completely overcame the fourth of these things. Now, those are just four background notes as far as the picture was concerned.
This series is continued on the next cassette.